and welcome, heroes, to the Crit Academy. I am your host, Justin.
And I'm your co-host, Ian.
This podcast was created to provide you, our heroes, with new and reusable material for both players and DMs.
We hope to inspire you with creative content that they can bring with you on your next adventure.
Our show may not be suitable for young children.
But neither is our D&D games.
That's right. We want to thank you all for joining us today here at Crit Academy Studios, where everything's made up and your roles don't matter.
Yeah, your roles are like a cavalier with no mount.
Before we get started, I want to let you know this episode is brought to you by our generous Patreon donors. I want to thank all of our Patreon donors, Gabe, Jome, Joe, Rick, all of you guys that really just help support our show and really keep us wanting to do it. I mean,
remember me, what's the current number right now?
We have currently 9 right now.
Yes, thanks to all 9 of you.
Hey, you know what? That's 9 more than I had a year ago.
I know.
So that's
no,
awesome.
No. I did not mean that in a bad way. I mean, you 9, you're awesome.
Yeah, right. But we want to thank you guys very much. You make your contributions help us keep the show running. So we like to start off every show on a high note, and the best way to do that is to give away wonderful prizes.
Each episode, we will draw one lucky subscriber's name, and they will win the 5-star rated adventure, Banquet of the Damned, Compliments of Goblinstone. Goblinstone is a community project for D&D fans based out of the UK. They aim to be a place where you can team up with professionals to turn your ideas into high-quality products and give every fan a chance to get published. Be sure to head over to www.goblinstone.com. Or you can check out our fellowship link on our website, www.critacademy.com.
Who's our winner this week?
I would say today's winner is temporarysanity.okc.
Man, that song just makes me want to bop and start dancing, doesn't it?
I just noticed his name he went chicken.
Okay. Congratulations, temporary insanity.
That OKC.
That OKC.
That's like that's
not
like,
KFC.
Yeah.
If you when you play the adventure and you enjoy it, please make sure to leave a review and what you like and what you didn't like so they can improve future products.
Mm-hmm.
I was gonna say he gave us a copy of Chapel on the Hill. And it's better. It's a huge step up. I mean, his Goblinstone's Adventure Banquet of the Damned was already awesome.
Yeah. Well,
the newest one is just, his bar just keeps growing. So, and that's all thanks to the feedback he gets.
It's all thanks to viewers like you.
Joe says we should do a Crit Academy music video to that song. We'll see what we can do for you.
And you're looking at me, that one, of course you are.
Well, I don't have a fancy video camera to record, and plus, you know, I've got the will. We just need the equipment, right?
Right.
Which is that's your specialty. So
it kind of is.
Congratulations, temporary insanity. Temporary sanity.
That OKC.
Whatever. We got a really great show for you today. I'm really excited. We're going to be doing the class analysis on Xanathar's Guide to Everything's Fighter Archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really exciting because one of the fighters is one of my favorite classes because it's so much freedom for me.
The fighter is quite versatile.
Yeah. We have a really great question in regards to grappling, which I'm excited about. And, of course, we have our Unearthed Tips and Tricks segment. Now, for Unearthed Tips and Tricks segment, I've got something very interesting that I want to talk about specifically with the encounter because... we'll get to that later. It's a really good one. But before all that, we have In the Realm. Ian, what's been going on in your realm?
A lot, which is a complete contrast to what I usually say here. Because let me see. You know what? It might be better if I work backwards. Last night, I went to the annual Grinch party, which is what a party that my uncle and his college roommates are doing way back in the 80s.
That's weird.
Well, basically what they do is they watch How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the original animated one, mind you.
Okay.
And they basically turn it into a drinking game.
So do you take a drink every time he, like, does something, or?
The main game is every time the word who is said.
Oh, geez. You'd be tanked within a few minutes.
They do say quite a bit in 23 minutes.
Very cool. Yeah.
And, of course, the day before that, I went and watched Star Wars.
Okay, so, yes, that's actually the juicy thing I want to talk about. So, I'm a Star Wars person, but I'm not, like,
I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that everybody who watches this show is a Star Wars person too, in some capacity.
Yeah, I would almost agree with that. The only so no spoilers, but obviously, what did you think?
Short version, the movie itself, I liked it.
Yes.
If you're a Star Wars fan, I say check it out. And kind of in the same regard, though, I do have to say that what I'm seeing on Facebook, though, from what a lot of people are saying about in regards to the new Star Wars movies, in a word, chill.
Yeah, no joke. Some people are so tied into all the canon and everything, and when something's not perfect, they lose their shit. Well, and that's I guess that's fans of anything. Even when I'm following the Facebook groups of D&D, people lose their shit if you don't do it their way.
As some people point out, it's like, guys, when they made Episode 7, you complained it was too much like A New Hope. And when they made this movie, some people complained it was too different from Star Wars. Make up your mind.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why George Lucas is probably glad he got out of it, because no matter what he did, it was never good enough for the fans.
And the other thing, too, is like I've seen people like jump on somebody else for even the smallest things about the newest movie, too. In fact, I saw one person go on a huge rant about how a Alan Arkell had a huge spoiler in the title, to which I replied to them, it is not a spoiler if you watch the trailers.
Right. I'm actually one of I'm not a super huge Star Wars fan. I love Star Wars, don't get me wrong, but yeah. I've never dressed up and gone as a Jedi or anything like that. Though I do have a lightsaber that I got that I custom built from Disney World, which was pretty cool. But cool. I'm one of the few people that actually my very first Star Wars movie was the Phantom Menace.
Okay.
So that is my favorite one, and I get a lot of heck for it. That being said, I don't think that's a bad movie, but every other Star Wars fan, oh, it's the worst movie ever. I was like, I thought it was awesome, but, you know, that's me. And now,
I think we have Jar Jar to blame for that one.
I like Jar Jar, so.
You're probably also a kid when you watch it, too.
I also, I was a kid. But anyways, so I like the new one. I don't think it's the best one they've come out with, personally.
But I think it's far from the worst.
But yeah, but I did enjoy it. It was very thoroughly enjoying. The issue I had was, I don't feel like that Snoke got the, I think he got the shaft. With all the talk and all the ideas that came up out of the fans and the theories and stuff, what they did was kind of a letdown, I think.
Like, you didn't get the payoff that people wanted.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was probably my biggest letdown. But the other thing that I thought was just amazing is, like, 20 seconds of Luke stole the film.
It's true.
With 20 seconds, and it just blew. I was amazed by it. So
for me, without giving away anything, my personal favorite was the hyperdrive scene.
Yes, okay. That was good.
And that's all I have to say about it. Those who've seen it know what I'm talking about.
Go watch it. It's good. So if they want to learn more about Star Wars and other realms, where can they go, Ian?
They can check out our sponsor, Audible, where they can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial. That is, if they go to audibletrial.com/critacademy.
You can also check out, we have a link right on our website, too.
That usually helps.
Audible has over 180,000 titles for you to choose from, so you're definitely going to find something that you like. Moving on to our next segment, we have our Let's Talk About Blank segment. We have a, I really like questions like this, but this is a little more mechanic-heavy question, but I think it's very, probably something that comes up often. Joel Michalowski, do you think I got that right?
I hope so.
Joe asks, let's say a Goliath barbarian tries to pick up a human and drop him on his knee, like Bane did to Batman. I'm guessing it would either be an attack roll or an athletics check, or maybe both. Let's say the Goliath has a +5 strength. My question is, how much damage would this deal? Do you want me to go first on this?
This is your
okay.
This
so, is your shtick. So first of all, from a very technical standpoint, this would probably be an unarmed strike. If you want to talk raw, it'd be an unarmed strike, and it would be 1 damage plus your strength modifier. Now, as a person who loves to grapple, that to me isn't good enough. If your goal is to break their back like Bane did to Batman, this isn't going to do it. Now, I could see an argument being made for maybe improvised weapon damage.
Sure.
Maybe 1d4 plus strength as well. But from a raw, I'm pretty sure it's just an unarmed strike. Additionally, if you're big and tall, say a Goliath in this case, and you're 7 foot tall, and you're holding them way up, I would even go to the point to give them like additional fall damage too, because it could be arguably 10 feet drop, right?
Right.
So aside from all those things, to me, this is more of something that you would do to as like a finishing move or to somebody that's on at zero hit points already. I would argue that in this case, in the case he makes, Batman already was at zero HP.
Right.
Batman was already effed up. He couldn't do a whole lot against it, you know, so...
I mean, taking the original story Nightfall into account, this was at the point where Bane did release all of the occupants of Arkham. He spent weeks exhausting Batman. Because Batman kept on pushing himself to catch mm-hmm. everybody. So, by the time Bane did show up, Batman was mentally and physically exhausted. In fact, just beforehand, Batman even himself said, "I just got cut by Zaz." Zaz. I am off my game right now, and that's when Bane showed up.
Yeah, to me,
now to be fair, Bane did plan it out that way, right. So.
And now I'm the type of DM who much prefers to really engage the players to the best of my ability and reward that very creative thought process. So if a player said he wanted to do this, I would let them certainly try and do the damage. But obviously, if the person didn't drop to zero HP, it wouldn't be like a backbreaker, right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't do what he intended. Maybe they would twist at the last second and land on their side and bend awkwardly.
Kind of like I remember how you tried to choke out enemy NPCs a few times
with my sling,
right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, there's no rule in the game about this crap.
But as far as damage is concerned, if you want to follow Raw, it's gonna be 6 damage in the example that he gives, which isn't a whole lot
if you hit
right. But you actually just made a good point. This says he asks about it being an attack roll or an athletics check that I totally shot over. If he's already got him grappled in D&D 5th edition, is just movement 0. That's it. There's no additional benefit other than that.
Right.
So this, I would argue that this is in fact an attack roll, period.
Right.
Yes. I would give him advantage if he was already grappled.
Right.
I would also say that this condition might even require the opponent to be grappled to do this.
Right.
Right. So you're talking 2 steps. Now, if you've got double attack, or extra attack, you can grapple him with the first one and try to drop him on your knee the second one. But
now keep in mind, this is assuming the guy who's doing the grappling's not a monk.
Grappling monks are pretty effective, but yeah, they're not nearly as like potent in this case as a barbarian. But if you are trying to look for more other opportunities and ways to get your abilities in there, Joe mentions that he would run it as a coup de grace, and that's kind of what we talked about earlier with him already being at 0 hit points. So I agree. I would, but I wouldn't make it only a condition for coup de grace.
Sure.
It can do damage, and then maybe it doesn't break their back. But if it did bring them to 0, or they were already at 0, I agree 100%. Coup de grace, boom, they're done. So there are some specific mechanics that can be addressed if you really want to try to get down to it. So first we'll talk about the Tavern Brawler stuff. Great for improvised weapon. Pretty much anything can be a weapon in 1d4 damage. So if you're going for that type of build,
in this case, your enemy's body is a weapon.
Right.
Against itself.
Or smashing their faces on the tables. You also get stuff like the Battlemaster maneuvers, the trip, the push, the precise attack. All those different stuff can easily be flavored into your...
Sure.
Your melee grappling and your however you want to manhandle or womanhandle these baddies. All those can be used to emulate, you know, specific wrestling moves. But anyways, aside from all that, there's a lot you can do with that, and there are other moves, especially between the Battlemaster and the monks on arm strikes to really handle that. So, is there anything else we missed? Reading back to the question, I think we hit on everything.
In some way, she perform, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, I love this concept. I love grapplers. My most fun that I've had with any type of fighter character is a grappler, because just smashing people's faces into random objects is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, though. I kind of wished 5th edition handled unarmed combat a little bit better, because I didn't like the fact that it's basically your strength score +1 for damage.
Well, but if you think about this, though, a +5 strength score with a 1 point of damage can kill a normal person.
Right.
I mean, so...
I just don't like how it just seems to be only the monks that seem to be the one who rules any type of damage
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, and I think Brian and... not Brian. The fuck is Brian? Ryan and I have talked extensively how he house rules that unarmed strike by default are 1d 4 plus your strength mod,
which I prefer.
Yeah, and that's kind of his point. He's like, yeah, I don't, he didn't, he kind of was in the same mindset that the 1 point of damage plus strength wasn't adequate to represent a giant Goliath that can probably punch through a door or a wall.
Yeah, well, that, and I can also picture like underground, like boxing leagues and stuff too. Yeah. And like a boxer's not a monk, but they're going to, they should be doing way more damage than
anyways,
because their entire shtick is punching things.
Well, not just punching though, kicking, kneeing, elbowing.
I said boxers.
Oh, okay. Well, they elbow too. No, they know kickboxing is like kneeing. Well, what, boxing is boring anyway. Why are you bringing that in here? So, Joe Michalowski, we hope we answered your question. If we didn't, there's a million people out there smarter than us that can give you a better breakdown. So go talk to them. But thank you very much for your submission, and we do hope we answered your question. So moving on to our main segment, I'm super excited for this. We are talking Xanathar's class analysis of the fighter. The fighter is perhaps the greatest paradox. On the one hand, a singular feature of the class is that no two fighters ply their craft in quite the same way. Their weapons, armor, and tactics differ across a vast spectrum. On the other hand, regardless of the tools and methods one uses, at the heart of every fighter's motivation lies the same basic truth. It is better to wound than it is to be wounded.
Indeed. And I do believe the fighter class is one of the classes that gets a bad rap, because a lot of people keep saying is, all they do is hit stuff. Yes, they do hit stuff, and they are good at hitting
stuff. They're
very
good at it. And, you know, you can get a lot of creative... The reason I like fighter and barbarian in those classes is because, well, because they're so... Everything can be reflavored to such an extent that you can completely change the way the class is just by doing it differently. You know, I had a normed monk once, because an unarmed strike wasn't about punching. It was about unarmed strike.
Kick, knee, headbutt.
Yes.
Shoulder rush.
Hip thrust.
Backflip.
Anyways, so that brings us into our first archetype in the Xanathar's Guide, which is the Arcane Archer.
The Arcane Archers are some of the most elite warriors among the elves. They stand over the fringes of the elven domains, keeping a keen eye out for trespassers, and using magic-infused arrows to defeat monsters and invaders before they reach elven settlements.
Love it, love it, love it, very much. So, the first feature that you gain access to as an Arcane Archer is at level 3 when you choose this archetype. You learn Arcane Archer lore. At 3rd level, you learn the magical theory and some of the secrets of nature, typical of the practitioners of this elven martial tradition. You choose and gain a proficiency in either Arcana or Nature skill, and you get to learn the Prestidigitation or the Druidcraft cantrip.
And both those cantrips are pretty awesome outside of combat, not gonna lie.
I love Prestidigitation.
But don't underestimate Druidcraft either, because... you'll never go hungry with this cantrip.
those are some pretty good, useful cantrips that you get right off the bat. And we've talked at extended length at the utility of Prestidigitation. So go back and listen to those episodes.
Right.
Just off of the tip of your the old dome, what do you think would be a good single use for either one of these to fit this particular theme?
Well, generally speaking, going by the lore, it is the elves that know this stuff, and they tend to be tied to nature, so I could easily see a elf using Druidcraft, for example, to live off the land.
Okay, very cool. Especially if you're kind of...
at the fringes.
Yeah, right, right.
And I would say, also at level 3, when you choose this archetype, you gain one of their standout features, which is the Arcane Shot, where you basically infuse your arrows that you fire, that you hit with magic, to... use some of the arcane shot abilities, which is, I would say that they're basically a magic version of the battle master's battle maneuvers, more or less.
Yeah, that's you're pretty spot on, but there are some big differences, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, like once per turn, when you fire a magic arrow from your short or long bow as part of the attack action, you can apply one of these to your one of the arcane shot options, which is there's a list like.
And notice it says when you hit.
Yes.
Not when you miss, not before you shoot, when you hit. That's a huge deal. That's like the smite, right? You don't need to call and do it until it hits.
But it also does say once per turn, because if you multi-attack...
Right. You can't extra attack into it and get extra shots.
On a side note, I do believe they did say in Sage Advice that they did say they forgot to put in crossbow, which was just the oversight on their part.
And that's not the only thing they've mentioned in Sage Advice regarding this particular feature.
No.
It says when you fire a magic arrow from your short bow or longbow, it is, in fact, not a magic arrow.
Yes.
It does not require that. They had to clear that up in Sage Advice. That is a known misprint, that you don't have to, like, go and find magic arrows to shoot to trigger this. It's just automatic.
And you can only use, like, an arcane shot twice per rest, too, basically.
Right, but it recovers after a short rest, which is pretty cool, right? Yeah.
And you do gain more. And you start off with two options, and you gain more as you level up.
Molly actually is playing one right now. And she says it is a tad bit complicated, so if Molly wanted to elaborate on that for us, that would be fantastic, and maybe we can address it.
Real-time feedback.
That's the way we roll.
If you're a Patreon, that is.
Yeah, if you're a Patreon. Patron. I broke you. You're doing it now. So we are going to do a quick overview of the arrows here. The first choice you get is Banishing Arrow.
And it may disappear for a turn if they fail their charisma save.
Yeah, it banishes them to another location, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the Feywild. Okay, so to me, anytime you can remove something from combat, even for a short while, is powerful, because that allows everyone, and say you got two big enemies, and if you can take one out for a single round, that allows everyone to focus on the one guy for at least an entire round, making all the difference, because let's be honest, it can be really hard to convince everybody to focus fire.
Yeah.
Why is that so hard? I have no idea. We all know it.
I know.
The numbers match that you kill this thing first, party takes less damage, less problems, right? And things die quicker, but even in spite of that. So this is a good way to kind of help force that a little bit.
And this does do additional damage at level 18. So.
Now, if you're shooting an arrow that does a banishing effect, what do you think it looks like? Because it doesn't really talk about what it looks like.
I think it looks like how any way you want, but I could easily see the arrow start... just turn to, like, radiant energy on the impact, and they disappear in a flash.
I just imagine you shooting an arrow, and it opening up into a portal and just swallowing the person, and then closing up as they go over them.
That works, too.
Next, we have the Beguiling Arrow. Your enchantment magic causes the arrow to temporarily beguile your targets. The creature hit by the arrow takes an extra 2d psychic damage, and...
2d6 psychic damage.
What did I say?
2D psychic damage.
Well, that's weird. All right. The creature hit by the arrow takes an extra 2D6 psychic damage, and you choose one of your allies within 30 feet of the target. The target must succeed on a wisdom saving throw or is charmed by the chosen ally until the start of your next turn. Now, so you shoot somebody and they are charmed by you. Now, this reminds me of, like, Cupid.
And first off, they do take damage no matter what.
Which is cool, right? That's a pretty big deal. But this reminds me of Cupid. I just, like, describe a little energy heart arrow on this end of it as a... and a little heart pops up when you hit him.
And next up on deck, we have Bursting Arrow, where you imbue your arrow with force from the School of Evocation. And this energy detonates on impact. And as you hit the creature, the target... and all creatures within 10 feet of the target takes 2d6 force damage.
So when I was reading this before, the first thing I thought of, you remember the green arrow with the boxing glove?
Yep.
What I totally envision is an energy boxing glove appearing on the end of this thing, loosing it, and then, like, dozens of little tiny boxing gloves go poof, out and hit everything.
And at 18 level, it increases to 4d6 damage. And I think I'm seeing a theme here with level 18.
Yeah, I think at level 18, they all increase by 4d6. Or by 8. Yeah, 4d6, I think. Or by 8 set amount of damage.
Or just doubles.
Yeah. So, next, you get access to Enfeebling Arrow. You weave a necromantic magic into your arrow. The creature hit by the arrow takes an extra 2d6 necrotic damage.
There you go.
They must succeed a constitution saving throw, or the damage dealt by its weapon attacks is halved until the start of your next turn. So, how do you envision this working once it hits them?
Maybe a little bit of black tar in the face that burns on impact. I mean, that's no more poison than necrotic, but still.
Yeah, I kind of see them aging quickly and then flipping back or yeah, the melting could be a good one too, right? They're getting kind of weak in the knees a little bit.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And speaking of poison, with Grasping Arrow, when this arrow strikes its target, Conjuration Magic creates Grasping Poisonous Brambles, which wraps around them, and the creature hit by this takes an extra 2d6 poison damage.
And its speed is reduced by 10 feet, and then it takes 2d6 slashing damage the first time on each unit moves 1 foot or more without teleporting. And of course, and there's a, they get a save, and if they succeed on their strength athletics checks, they do break the arcane shot save DC. And otherwise, the barrels just last for a minute.
Or until you use the option again.
Okay, so these...
And more damage at level 18.
Yeah, so these little brambles come up and try to grasp the person. Now, depending on what type of theme you're going for, those brambles could be like claws or hands or...
Barbed wire.
Or barbed wire or any other type of flavor you wanted it to be. And then also you get... the next choice you would have is the piercing arrow, where you can use transmutation magic to give your arrow an ethereal quality. That's cool. When you use this option, you don't make an attack roll for the attack. Instead, the arrow shoots forward in a line, which is 1 foot wide and 30 foot long, before disappearing. The arrow passes harmlessly through objects, ignoring cover. Each creature in that line must make a dexterity saving throw. On a failed save, the creature takes damage as if it were hit by the arrow, plus an extra 1d6 piercing damage. And on a successful save, they take half as much damage. And of course, that increases at level 18. Now... this, I think, is one of the first abilities I've seen that an archer can shoot in a line. Am I mistaken?
I don't think you're wrong.
This is really cool, because not only does it shoot in a line and hit multiple targets if you line them up, say, funneling them into a tunnel or a hallway, but it passes through cover.
It just keeps going.
That's huge. It's like the Energizer Bunny. It just keeps going and going. That's a huge deal. If you can really get a good strategic group, you can make so much, you get so much use out of this shot.
Oh yeah.
So, and of course, if somebody's hiding behind a shield, ha ha, too bad. That's the way to does that also mean they got to be careful to not hit? They got to be careful not to hit their allies too.
I think that would be a logical conclusion.
So I can see somebody accidentally getting a phase arrow shot in their ass.
Back to the fireballing wizards.
So that's a really cool one.
It's not my fault you're inside the blast radius.
You know what I kind of want to do? When I was first reading this, before, when I was writing the show notes, I was imagining taking on... I love dragoons, if you haven't watched enough of the shows to realize that yet. Taking on like a very much a dragon theme of all my attacks, and I can see my arrows getting like specters of like lengthy dragons kind of over the arrow as they're flying through. That would be so cool. And this is the first one I think a very translucent or ethereal dragon would be really cool.
Indeed.
Joe says the arcane archer equals a railgun. That is awesome. Love that. Next we have the seeking arrow.
And you use divination magic, which grants your arrow the ability to seek out a target. And when you use this option, you don't make an attack roll, but instead you choose one creature you have seen within the past minute, and the arrow flies towards that creature, moving around corners and ignoring three covers.
The heat-seeking cover. Arrow.
Yeah. The Patriot arrow from Robin Man Tights. And if the target is within the weapon's range and there's a path large enough for the arrow to travel to the target must make a dex saving throw. Otherwise, the arrow disappears after traveling as far as it can. And on the failed saves, the target takes damage as if it were hit by the arrow plus a d6 force damage. And you learn the target's current location.
That's awesome. A heat-seeking arrow?
Yep.
I mean, honestly...
A heat-seeking locating arrow.
I mean, that's crazy. It very much is... I feel like you can have a lot of fun with this just being a douche. Just like standing... Because it doesn't say you need to... You don't need to see it, right?
Nope.
So you can basically just shoot around corners. Like, I'm just going to shoot my arrow around there based on like perception checks. Do I hear anybody around that corner? I'm going to shoot them.
Only if you see them within 1 minute.
Oh, so you wouldn't if you'd have to see them first. Yeah, I guess that's still pretty cool though. It's like a lock-on mode,
right? And if they do make the save though, they take half damage, and you don't learn their location.
Yeah.
And more damage.
You can always listen for an arrow hitting somebody. Ah! Give away their location.
Maybe. Does this make Yondu an arcane archer? Maybe. Maybe.
You know what? I would say so. Didn't we do a magic item that was based on his little thing? Was that a bow?
I want to say no, but don't quote me on that.
I feel like we did. I feel like there was a magic item that was based on that. But I don't remember if it was an arrow, a bow or an arrow or an item. That, I don't remember. Shit. Anyway. And lastly, you have access to Shadow Arrow. You weave illusion magic into your arrow, causing it to occlude your foe's vision with shadows. The creature hit by the arrow takes an extra 2d6 psychic damage. Did I get it right?
You said 2d6.
Okay.
Not 2d psychic damage.
And it must succeed on a wisdom saving throw or be unable to see anything farther than 5 feet away. Now, until the start of your next turn. Now, what that tells me is that pretty much gives everyone the unseen attacker feature.
That could be useful.
So basically, this arrow allows you to give all your allies that can shoot or hit a target outside of the 5 foot range advantage on their attacks.
Yep.
So if you're running a high range group, this could be a very potent ability to take if you're looking for. Now, it doesn't. It even increases your damage, so there's really no reason not to take it if you've got more than one ranged attacker in your group, I think, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
And it can make great for escaping, too, right? Because if you hit them with it and then run away, I mean, you got 6 seconds to get out of dodge. You can cover a lot of ground in a busy place in 6 seconds.
You can.
So, all right, so I think that covers it for all the Arcane Archer arrow things. I kind of wanted to touch on what Molly was saying. Molly mentioned earlier she had some, she thought it was a little bit, overwhelming or
complex.
And we did just learn that it's because she multi-classed with the Horizon Walker Ranger. Not to be confused with Walker Texas Ranger. But,
no.
And that alone will definitely make something far more complex because now you're trying to track multiple features.
From multiple classes.
Yes. So I would say that's less of a Arcane Archer complexity and more of you multi-classing complexity.
Yep.
Because multi-classing is far more complex if you're not super familiar with the classes, too.
It does make it for more bookkeeping at the very least.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, we are all the way down there. All right, so now kind of moving back to the features that you get of the Arcane Archer.
And at level 7, you gain the ability to infuse your arrows with magic. Maybe that's why it's called the Magic Arrow feature.
Yeah, look at that.
And whenever you fire a non-magical arrow from the short bow or longbow, and I guess crossbow, you make it magical for the purpose of overcoming resistance and immunity to non-magical attacks and damage. And the magic fades from the arrow immediately after it hits or misses its target.
Yeah. Now, once again, you know that I love to flavor stuff, and I love for it to really be unique. This is when just because that says all it does is for overcoming resistances, you can really do a lot with this and describe how you're flavoring it. I mentioned the flying arrow dragon thing a second ago, where you can give all your arrows the effect, some sort of visual effect, whether it's a dragon or a lion or a boxing glove or what have you.
Or maybe you're make a sign boom when you fire them.
Oh, that's cool. Just send out a small little shockwave around you. See, that's cool. I like. So take advantage of stuff like this and try to incorporate your character's unique personality into them when you do it. You know, like if I was a tiefling with this, I'd probably make like ethereal fire or horn, a horn or something, you know?
Yep.
Very cool. At 7th level, you also get access to Curving Shot. You learn how to direct an errant arrow towards a new target. When you make an attack roll with a magic arrow and miss, you can then use your bonus action to re-roll the attack roll against a different target within 60 feet of the original target.
Which shouldn't usually be a problem.
Yeah, but still, that's huge, right?
Oh, yeah.
You get to... I missed? Fuck that. Screw that.
It is a bonus action to keep in mind, but still useful.
But still, I guess if you're a... What all is a fighter going to use his bonus action for?
Well, depends on what kind of fighter you are.
I mean, if you're dual-wielding, you're probably not using the Arcane Archer, so...
Probably not.
I don't know. I can't think of a lot offhand, but...
I'm sure there's something. I just can't think of it right now.
But I feel like the most of the time, you could use this.
Right.
And not be... It shouldn't hamper your mechanics that often.
Nope.
I mean, obviously, what's the one you... The gain life, the second wind. That's a bonus action, but other than that...
Actually, let me double-check that.
Okay.
Because I remember hearing...
Shandu.
He may be your father, but he ain't your daddy.
Mary Poppins, y'all.
I love all the fan art that came online after that line. Sure. Yeah. Yep, it's a bonus action. On your turn.
Yeah, okay. All right, anyways.
Because I remember reading some people online saying, no, you can use that anytime.
No.
I'm like, let me double check that.
Anytime on your turn.
Right.
As long as you got a bonus action.
Anywho.
You want to take the next one?
And next up on deck at level 15 is the Ever Ready Shot.
And you have your magical archery whenever battle starts. And when you roll initiative and you have no use of arcane shot, you get one more use of it.
And since you only have two uses in the first place, that actually worked out pretty good.
Yeah, it that's actually... So the fighter usually gets a lot of their stuff back on a short rest.
Right.
At 15th level, that limitation is almost... I mean, for this feature, is almost gone at that point because you only have a few uses of it. So
almost.
You can go longer combats without having to worry about not being able to do more than just loosen an arrow. So that does it for the Arcane Archer.
Just to roll back for a second, the Magic Arrow ability at level 7, it of course did say any arrow you fire becomes magical for overcoming damage resistances.
Immunities, or resistance and immunities.
One thing I was never quite able to figure out is, let's say you have a magical bow that's just a plus whatever weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Do any arrows that fire become magical for that purpose, or no?
I don't know the answer to that.
Neither do I. And I didn't see anything in the DMG that outright said one way or another.
I really don't know.
Because I do know they gave additional rules for magical
ammunition. Any of our listeners know?
Because I know they gave rules for magical ammunition, so...
Well, yeah, because... You know what? I don't think it would. Because they're specifically in the DMG, magical ammunition. But is that so you can fire magical arrows out of a non-magical bow?
Right. But... I mean, you're right, there's magical ammunition, but I don't think that is enough to say that non-magical arrows from magical bow aren't magical for the impact purposes from that weapon.
Yeah, I would probably say no, it's not, I don't have any...
Yeah, I'm leaning that way too, but I can't prove it.
Right. I would say that if it doesn't say they're magical, then I would say it's not. I would say if it wanted the arrows to be magical, it would say that. Right, it would say that this bow's ammunition is magical for purposes of overcoming damage and immunities.
But I also believe there are a lot of things, too, that aren't said that are still true anyway, though.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do, though. I will try to look that up in the next day or so and see if I can get an answer and maybe...
Maybe they mentioned the Sage Advice already.
But they may have. I don't know. We'll have to check into that.
They mentioned a lot of stuff in Sage Advice.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if one of our listeners pops in with an answer, so...
It'd be great if you did, saying.
We'll see.
Anywho...
I'm all the way down here, right? Good.
Next up is the Cavalier.
I really like this class. Cavalier is equally at home leading a cavalry charge or exchanging words at a state dinner. Compelled to right wrongs or earn prestige, many of these fighters leave their lives of comfort to embark on glorious adventure.
And the first thing they get when you become a Cavalier is you gain some more proficiencies, which is always awesome, because you gain your choices of... One of your choices of animal handling, history, insight, performance, or persuasion. And alternatively, you choose one additional language of your choice.
That's cool.
It is cool.
I like when you get bonus anything.
Yep.
I like bonuses. That's why they're my favorite type of paycheck.
And I do believe this helps drive home that the fighters can do stuff outside of combat.
Mm-hmm. I think that was pretty clear when they came out with the Purple Knight. Was it the Purple Dragon Knight that also was like a nobleman or...
Yeah.
Like very... type of person.
Not quite that direction.
Well,
yeah.
Whatever. I don't care. I'm tired.
But then again, I did use Flavor 1 to a douchebag drill sergeant, so...
He's a dick, but he's the kind of dick we want on our side.
At level 3, the first feature you get is Born to the Saddle. Your mastery as a rider is apparent. You have advantage on saving throws made to avoid falling off your mount. If you fall off your mount and descend no more than 10 feet, you can land on your feet if you're not incapacitated. That's pretty cool. Finally, mounting and dismounting only cost you 5 feet of movement rather than half your speed.
Which is pretty good too.
Excuse me. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's basically just your ability to... somersault off of the back of some wild beast.
Ha! But wait, at level 3, there is more.
You know what that kind of reminds me of? Do you ever watch those horse riders who do the flips and stuff up on and off the horse?
Yep.
I would totally be doing that. Like, as my horse is galloping by, I would, like, flip off the side, stab somebody, and flip back on and keep on going.
Yep. And at level 3, you also gain the Unwavering Mark, which you can use to menace your foes, spoiling your attacks and punishing them for harming others. And when you hit a creature with a melee attack, you can mark them until the end of your next turn.
And this ends early if you're incapacitated or die, or if somebody else marks it. And while it's within 5 feet of you, a creature marked by you has disadvantage on any attack roll that is not you. And in addition, if a creature marked by you deals damage to anyone other than yourself, you can make a special melee bonus attack against the marked creature as a bonus action on your next turn, which you, by the way, have advantage on this attack roll. And if it hits, the attack's weapon damage deals extra to the target equal to half your fighter level. That can add up pretty quick.
Yeah, it can. So that's pretty cool, right?
Hold up. And regardless of the number of creatures you mark, you can still make this attack a number of times equal to your strength modifier. And you regain it all after a long rest. Not short rest, long rest.
That's so awesome.
Except for the long rest part, yeah.
Well, but no, but still. This gives you a mark that allows you to protect your allies by imposing disadvantage, right? At no cost to any of your features, right?
I mean, you do aggro, basically.
Yeah, which is, that's a huge deal. What, it doesn't say which, does it take a bonus action?
Nope. It says when you hit.
Yeah, so there's no additional requirement of you, no loss of action economy or anything.
Nope.
That's pretty cool. You can just do it.
You just draw aggro.
How do you envision that working mechanically?
Over here, idiot.
So kind of like insulting, maybe?
Could be.
Or are you just engaged with them so close and so fine you've mastered keeping their focus away from others?
Or just well-positioned enough to where you have some sort of way to hamper them somehow.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Now, there's a lot of people who would be really excited for this because they were sad that there wasn't really... In 4th edition, there was a lot. Marking was a thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not in 5th edition. And there were some people that were kind of bugged about that and no way to force people to focus on you.
Well, there were some times, though, during the playtest when every time they tried to mark stuff, people complained. But those guys just complained because it's the only thing else 4th edition. So.
Okay. At 7th level, you gain access to Warding Maneuver. You learn to fend off strikes directed at you, your mount, and other creatures nearby. If you or your creature you can see within 5 feet of you is hit by an attack, you can roll 1d8 as a reaction if you are wielding a melee weapon or a shield. Roll the die and add that number rolled to the target's AC against the attack. If the attack still hits, the target is target has resistance against the attack's damage.
Nice.
You can use this feature a number of times equal to your con modifier, minimum of once. And you regain all expended uses when you finish a long rest.
Upping your allies... AC, that's pretty nice.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically you jumping in front of a oncoming blade or attack.
Ooh.
And trying to stop it from hitting an ally.
Add this to the defender feature for shield builders.
That'd be nice. So now, because the sword and shield feature, what is it called? Is it called defender? It's not called defender, is it?
Protection.
The protection
fighting style.
Okay, the fighting style protection really goes really well with this because that imposes disadvantage on anybody that's attacked that's within 5 feet of you.
Yeah.
Which is very similar. So now if you take this and they get disadvantage and they still hit, you can...
Actually, no, I don't think you can read this again because they're both reactions. So.
Oh, are they?
So it's one or the other.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you can either impose disadvantage or, well, you have a limit on this one, too, which is equal to your con modifier, so it'd be
right.
One or the other.
Whereas the only limit you have on protection is the reaction.
Yeah. So this one's, it's kind of...
And you must be wielding a shield.
So what do you think would be better, the protection or this?
I think they're both good, just for different reasons.
Yeah, I think
yeah, the big thing though about the warning maneuver is it says if you have a shield or a melee weapon, whereas
which means you don't require a shield,
right?
That would be the trade-off. Okay, so this can be something done for a more offensive build, which I guess Cavalier is.
Yep,
but it still gives some defender qualities. I imagine if I'm galloping on my horse, get up, and then
yeah,
like I'm just happen to be stopped right next to the thing and trying to fend the guy off with my giant lance.
And next we have at level 10, Hold the Line, where you become a master of locking down your enemies. And creatures that provoke an opportunity attack from you when they move 5 feet or more while they're within your reach. And if you hit a creature with an opportunity attack, that creature's speed is reduced to 0 until the end of your current turn.
That's awesome.
So it's like the Polearm Master for free.
Yeah. Well, it's not for free. It takes 10 levels to get there.
Well, yeah.
But it doesn't require a feat to do it. So that's pretty cool. Sentinel feat or Polearm Master?
Actually, I think it is Sentinel. Now that you mention it.
Yeah, it's like the Sentinel feat where you can just stop somebody in their tracks.
But people taking both Sentinel and Polearm Master, though. It's yeesh.
Well, yeah, because then you have a long reach, and when they get close to you, you can swat them, and then they can't get closer. That's a very powerful combination.
It is. I mean, you're losing the stat boost because of it, but still.
Yeah, but if somebody can't hit you, the big barbarian charge and you stop him with a 10-foot pole, I don't think so. Very cool. So, yeah, I really like that. That's got, especially if you're using a lance, because a lance has got reach. This, you're right. This is literally the polearm combo if you're running a lance.
Or a pike, or a...
or any long a reach weapon, right?
Anything with a shaft. Okay, shaft. Not everything.
At 15th level, you get Ferocious Charger. You can run down your foes, whether you're mounted or not. That just sounds awesome. If you move at least 10 feet in a straight line right before attacking a creature, and you hit with the attack, the target must succeed a strength saving throw or be knocked prone. You can use this feature only once on each of your turns. So
they get a free bull rush.
Yeah, it's bull rush. And it's also similar to one of the... What is the... it's called Overrun. The Overrun optional option in the DMG.
Leroy Jenkins!
And now, being able to just knock somebody prone as part of your attack is huge. Because lest we forget, any target that's prone, any melee attackers have advantage on them.
Yep.
So that's a very tactical ability.
And briefly, though, range attackers have disadvantage against prone targets.
Yeah, so they can always shoot a different target.
I'm just saying that might be something to keep in mind depending on your party composition.
Right, right.
And last but not least, level 18, you get the Vigilant Defender, where you respond to danger with extraordinary vigilance. Go figure. It's in the name. In combat, you get a special reaction that you can take once on every creature's turn, except your turn. You can use the special reaction only to make an opportunity attack, and you can't use it on the same turn that you take your normal reaction. Nice.
That's pretty cool. You get a special reaction?
On every creature's turn, except yours.
Take an opportunity attack.
Yeah.
That really increases your action economy.
It really does.
Especially if you've got, like, a reach, because if you've got reach, it's much easier to hold a bunch of creatures in your attack of opportunity range.
Oh, yeah.
Your combat range. That's pretty sweet. For some reason, I just envision a guy with a lance just spinning in circles really fast as enemies are trying to get away.
Dude, this is on every creature's turn. Will that also include your allies?
Allies are a creature, so I would say so.
Man, somebody's going to get pummeled a lot.
Yeah. Well, and it can be... this really goes well with the previous ability, the hold the line, because you can lock them down and they can't escape your range.
And you just keep smacking them on each creature's turn.
Yeah. They can't escape. Conk, that's insane.
Conk.
Once again, I just imagine a guy with a giant lance just spinning in circles trying to hit everybody. So that'll do it for the Cavalier. I think this is really cool, and I really want to do a halfling with a bear mount, like the druid. That would be so much fun. That'd be a fun build.
And next, we definitely have the Samurai.
The Samurai. Yeah. Wait, that's more like Kung Fu, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, whatever. What's a samurai noise?
Hoi!
Hoyo! Sosai ho lion da!
And hopefully we don't get too racist with that.
Well, I'm not racist. My hallway monitor guy is a samurai. Do you want to take that?
The samurai is a fighter who draws on an implacable fighting spirit to overcome enemies. A samurai's resolve is nearly unbreakable, and the enemies in a samurai's path has two choices: yield or die fighting.
They forget run. Run is always an option.
No, I guess the samurai.
Well, I guess if you run and they shoot you in the back, you're still gonna die. At third level, you get bonus proficiencies. You gain proficiency in one skill of your choice, included in the history, insight, performance, and persuasion. And alternatively, you get to learn a language, which is fantastic.
Yep.
Representative of their travels, I'd imagine. Learn stuff they learned in their travels.
And also at third level, you gain Fighting Spirit.
where your intensity and belt can shield you and help you strike true. As a bonus action, on your turn, you give yourself advantage on weapon attack rolls until the end of your current turn. When you do so, you also gain 5 temporary hit points, which also increase at level 10 to 10
and 15 at 15. Well, it's consistent if anything.
And you can
And you can use this up to 3 times, which you regain after a short rest
or a long one.
So I envision the
you regain at the end of a long rest. Sorry.
Yeah.
It was in my defense, short rest in the playtest.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. They probably thought that giving yourself advantage repeatedly, almost every combat at that point, I would assume.
Yeah.
I envision the person taking their blade in their hand and taking a deep breath and channeling their inner chi and using that to guide their attack.
I just picture them drawing their blade going into a stance or focusing their next strike.
That's way cooler than what I said.
Yeah.
Like Kenshin's Bato Jutsu, where he bends over and he puts his hands in his thing sheath and just draws the blade in one tack and sheaths it back.
Something like
That's
that.
What I would be doing. Just whoosh. At 7th level, hang on. Yeah, at 7th level, you gain Elegant Courtier. Courtier, is that right?
Close enough.
What is it?
I don't know.
Oh, well, then how do you know it's close enough or not right?
Because it sounds close
courtier,
enough.
Courtier. An Elegant Courtier. At 7th level, your discipline and attention to detail allow you to excel in social situations. Oh, that's cool. Whenever you make a charisma persuasion check, you can gain a bonus to the check equal to your wisdom modifier. Your self-control also causes you to gain proficiency in wisdom saving throws. Is that the first ability that's not a feat to give somebody saving throw proficiency?
No. Other classes get this too.
Huh.
Not very many. But they're out there.
You have self-control that causes you to gain proficiency in saving wisdom saving throws. If you already have this proficiency, you instead gain proficiency in intelligence or charisma saving throws. Your choice. That's cool.
More saving throws is always a nice thing.
I would, if you could, I'd be taking intelligence just because no more of those stupid brain suckers. What are they called? The intelligence devourers? Or brain devourers?
Yeah. Illithids.
Yeah, the little brains that have that just walk. Little brain sucker things.
Oh, the intelligence devourer?
Is that what it's called?
Intellect devourer.
Intellect devourer. Yeah, those little bastards. That's a good way to fight those little bastards off. Can I hit the next one there?
At level 10, you gain Tireless Spirit. And when you roll initiative and you have no uses of fighting spirit remaining, you regain 1 use.
So basically, you can. It ensures that if you go into combat, you're not completely spent.
You've got at least 1.
So that's pretty cool.
And I point out that you gain this at level 10 when the temporary HP jumps up to 10.
Oh, nice. You can start off with a nice boost.
Yeah.
I would have to wear the really cool hat and the wooden shoes. You know what I mean? Taking a deep breath. And just relax and focus my zen, my inner chi, to regain that power. I feel like I would describe that every time combat started. I took in a deep breath and focused and really tried to get a little bit out of that. At 15th level, you gain access to Rapid Strike. You learn to trade accuracy for accuracy for swift strikes. If you take the attack action on your turn and have advantage on the attack roll against one of the targets, you can forgo the advantage for that roll and make 1 additional weapon attack against the target as part of the same action. You can do so no more than once per turn. So
I'm pretty sure this is meant to be used with fighting spirit.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Or against prone enemies, too, for that matter.
So you can give yourself advantage, then you can forgo that advantage to get an extra attack in.
Oh, combine that with if you're a dual-wielder.
Oh, that's cool. Because it says it's part of that action, which means it doesn't require an additional action. So,
no.
No, I don't think it's any additional because you're consuming. You're still using your bonus action.
No. No, you just give a banshee gain 1 more attack. It does not
consume. So, okay. So at this level, do you have the sheet that says how many extra attacks they have at this point? Is it 3?
Let me see here. Level 15. 2.
They've got 2 extra attacks? Because they get 1 at 5, so that's 2 attacks.
Yep.
And then they should have another one, right?
they get their third extra attack at level 20.
Oh, okay. So now you can make 4 attacks without being hasted with this feature.
5.
Right? No, it's 4 because you get your...
No, think about it. This is your second extra attack, so that's 3 attacks right there.
Oh, it's your second extra attack.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got 3 attacks there. You get 4th with your bonus action if you're dual-wielding.
Yep.
And then because it says it doesn't take an action, you can get a 5th with dual-wielding.
Yep.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That might bring that more in line with wielding two-handers. Because there's a big debate, right, on how what's better. I mean, I don't think it's a debate. I'm pretty sure two-handed is just superior in most cases.
I think it depends on which levels you're talking about,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, fair enough.
So.
Anyway, so that's really cool. You can forgo to gain an extra blow. That's amazing.
Because I think the breakdown was that lower levels, dual-wielding is better, but the more you level up, the more
once you get extra attack. Yeah, once they get extra attack, it's better.
Yeah.
I think. Where is it? The second extra attack. Yeah. Anyways, doesn't matter. Very cool. So you're making quick, rapid strikes at the cost of accuracy, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
You want to take that last one?
Strength before death.
That's such an awesome feature title.
At 18th level, your fighting spirit can delay the grasp of death. If you take damage, it reduces you to 0 hit points, and it does not kill you outright. You can use your reaction to delay falling unconscious, and you can immediately take an extra turn, interrupting the current turn. Nice. While you have 0 hit points during the extra turn, taking damage causes death saving throw failures as normal, and 3 death saving throw failures can still kill you. When the extra turn ends, you fall unconscious if you still have 0 hit points. Once you use this feature, you can't use it again until you finish a long rest. Now, it does say at the end of this extra turn, if you have 0 HP, that means you can use the extra turn to down a potion, use your second wind, what have you.
You can keep yourself alive.
Yeah.
And you can keep fighting.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Don't stop at the, you get enough.
Now, how do you envision this physically like affecting your character? I mean, what kind of... Because it basically just says you... can use your reaction to delay falling unconscious, okay? What do you envision your character actually doing at this point?
Sucking it up and shrugging it off.
See, I thought about that when I was reading it the first time, but I thought that's more of like what a barbarian would do, or the orc feature.
Yeah, and?
I don't know, I feel like being a samurai should be more zen-like. Like, you know what I mean? Like, your character takes a blow and takes a deep breath, like grabs onto the blade that's just pierced him and like rips it out.
That works too.
Gradually or something. I don't know. I feel like it just needed to be more. I don't know. More. I can't seem to articulate what I want to say. You know what I mean? Like the other options seem more like I'm gonna fight through it, but with the samurai, that doesn't feel like that fits.
Not necessarily. Because I mean, just because you're a calm guy most of the time doesn't mean you can't get pissed off.
It's true, but it doesn't say anything about rage or anything. It just says you can delay the grasp with death. Right. Or I would say maybe you're channeling your inner chi.
Or you're concentrating so intently on your opponent.
That you know, you forget about your wound?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I can see it kind of like them concentrating on their fighting spirit and sending that into a wound and stifling the pain and allowing them to endure fighting a little longer. So that does it for our fighter archetype for Xanathar's Guide to Everything. There's some really good stuff in here, and I really, really want to play an Arcane Archer right now, just after describing some of the different arrows.
I'm guessing the Arcane Archer is bad, but I kind of felt underwhelmed by it, personally.
Oh, yeah? Why?
I feel like that most of the stuff, not all, but most of the stuff is already covered by the Battlemaster.
Except for a lot of this stuff isn't covered by the Battlemaster.
I did not say all.
Not even any of it. None of these things can be done by the Battlemaster. I thought that was at first.
And I feel like the Battlemaster got more versatility, and they got more opportunities to use their die too, which is granted is smaller.
But they also can't pull an enemy out of the combat for a round, or they can't give all their allies advantage at once.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. Well, actually, they can. You knock an enemy prone.
Well, technically, if you do that, everyone can, but that's only for melee.
I'm just saying that, like, I kind of wish they did more to differentiate from the Battlemaster. Because it's basically, to me, it's like, okay, it's like the Battlemaster, but only less
times that their ability goes off with more dice.
See, I have to disagree, because I don't think any of these are... Not a single one of these is like anything the Battle Master can do. This one can charm people.
No, no, there is some overlap, but some of those techniques. Not all, but some.
Mm. I'm gonna have to disagree with you on that.
And that's fine.
We can move on.
That's fine. I guess when I pictured like arcing archer, like I fire an arrow, and where the arrow impacts, they then cast fireball on impact.
Well, you have an ability like that. It's just not fire damage; it's force damage.
But I mean the actual fireball spell, not... Anyway, moving
on.
Oh,
okay. You say you envision it like them actually chanting specific spells through it.
Into arrows, yeah.
I can kind of see that. That sounds like a good opportunity for a melee.
Because I feel like they've done that in previous editions or games, so...
Okay. So, before we move on to our Unearthed Tips and Tricks, which is my favorite, and it's your favorite, and it's not Ian's favorite... Before we move on to our Unearthed Tips and Tricks, we have one more gift to give away.
Each episode, we will draw another lucky subscriber's name, and they will win the best-selling adventure, The Claws of Madness, Compliments of Lawsmith. Lawsmith is a small indie team of creative artists who remember exploring the realms together with friends, finding incredible places, and meeting colorful characters along the way. They set out to deliver an experience that sparks those lasting impressions that pushed them to create their first standalone adventure, The Claws of Madness. This best-selling adventure is one that you don't want to miss.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah, because I just smack them and I break them. Who's our winner this week?
Truckee Cowboy.
Congratulations, Trekkie Cowboy. You are this week's winner of Loresmith's wonderful gift.
And you shall receive it, you shall play it, you shall enjoy it, and you shall spread the word.
Yes, make sure to head on over to Loresmith and leave him a review and let him know what you think. We had awesome Unearthed Tips and Tricks for you guys this week. I had a lot of fun come up with some of these ideas. So our first Unearthed Tips and Trick is our character concept. Pigpen. The idea behind this character is he is a stinky-ass mongrel. He never showers or bathes. He smells like rotting meat in a dumpster. Now, right offhand, how do you feel about that?
I actually play in a game where one guy roleplays a character like this.
Oh, yeah? And so what kind of stuff did he do to kind of give it the roleplay flavor?
Well, he plays a dwarf who thinks he's a human. Because he grew up in a sewer by himself.
We had that character concept on here once.
Right.
But how did that come into roleplay as far as like when he went upstairs?
Just how people reacted to him, which was usually discussed.
So the DM really played out pretty thoroughly how the NPCs and stuff reacted to him.
Yep.
Did it affect how if he was able to make any deals, or did they just do whatever they can to get rid of him, or...
Quite a few NPCs definitely kept him at arm's distance. No question about that.
I kind of envisioned this when I was thinking about it, because I was watching the old Dragon Ball, and one of the guys that they fought was called Bacterian. And he's walking around putting his ass or his hands in his thong, and he's pulling it out, and there's flies around it. He's like, he's holding it out, and people are like passing out and stuff. And cool. I just thought that it would make an amazing, I'm gonna hate to say grappler, but I think it would make an amazing grappler where he like sticks his hands in his pants and then pulls it out and then sticks it in their mouth. Like, what's that old wrestler's name? That did the Mr. Socko guy. You probably don't remember him.
No.
But he would, like, he'd have this nasty sock that never got washed and, like, grab people by the jaw with it. It was the nastiest thing. And I kind of envisioned something like that as kind of being a whole fighting technique. And he had this, like, find a way to get, like, an aura or something, that just an aura of stink that people suffered to be in. I should have made a monster concept with that. I should do that. So to me, it seemed like a really fun... roleplay opportunities, having you know, him going into a tavern looking for work, and everyone just doing, you know what, I need you to take care of these orcs, get up, go take care of them, and then when you're done, don't come back. You know, something like that. Having the NPCs really respond to him, and the players too, you know. Yep. Like maybe when an enemy's tracking them, they're tracking a smell, you know what I mean, like they went this way.
Yeah.
Does that somehow affect some of that? So to me, this Pigpen character seemed like a lot of fun. It could be a good way to, I think, to represent a low charisma character, because everyone always makes a low charisma character just not pretty. But no, what if it's not something you can't see? Maybe he looks immaculate, but he's just nasty as shit, you know?
Lots of B.O.
Yeah, well, not just B.O., but, like, maybe he doesn't wipe his ass when he shits, or he's got a big beard and his food gets caught in his beard and it just languishes there in, like, beard forever. So that is our character concept, Pigpen. If you use it, let us know, because that sounds hilarious.
And for our monster variant, the Cacton, which was originally the Awakened Tree. And the features we get was the slam damage type becomes piercing. And they also have the 100 needles ability, which recharges on a 5 or a 6. And the Cacton unleashes these needles in an explosive barrage from all over its body, sending piercing damage in all directions. Each creature other than the Cacton must make a dexterity saving throw. On a failed save, the creatures take a 3d4 plus 4 piercing, or half as much on a success.
I just realized that I actually forgot to put the feet in there. Additional feature would be needle barbs, which is basically just the tiefling racial feet that if they hug or touch or
yep.
anything like that, it deals damage to the person that's touching them. I got this idea because I was playing Final Fantasy and got died by a Cactuar.
I knew it.
I'm like, that's a shitty-ass monster. I hate that thing. And that stupid thousand needles thing and killed me. And I was like, that sucks. So I was really pissed off. And I'm like, you know what? Since I can't say Cactuar, right?
Yep.
I didn't want to name it Cactuar, so it's Cacton. But whatever. So this is a pretty simple one. With the origin being the Awakened Tree, it's not super powerful, but you could easily reflavor this as a Trent as well, using the Trent stat block, which is a much higher CR. But it's meant to be fun, and it can really give your deserts another interesting monster for them to fight, especially if they're trying to water it, and then it just shoots them with 100 needles. You know what I mean?
This stinks so much.
To me, this is a great addition to any desert combat. But it doesn't have to be just in desert, but that's kind of what the theme is. So what other challenges could you see with something like this?
Yeah, never know what the next cactus you see is going to do to you.
That's funny. That is our monster variant, the Cacton. Our encounter of the podcast, I am really excited for this. It's called Water Rites.
It kind of keeps the desert theme you got going on here.
You think? You said obviously for this really to be fully functional, it needs to be in a desert setting where water is scarce, or in an area where fresh water is scarce.
Uh-huh.
Not necessarily just water, but basically the heroes are hired to protect a man from would-be assassins or mobs, or somebody's trying to kill him, and he decides, I'm going to hire you, Ian, and I'm going to hire Joam, and you guys are to protect me. The land that the guy lives on is the only known aquifer or fresh source of water within 100 miles, whatever. You know, take your pick, however far you want it to be. What had happened is this town or this village that they were in was a really booming village until the owner of the property passed. And this other person got ownership of it, and now they're trying to monopolize on this resource that nobody else has access to. So he started either increasing the price, or maybe they weren't being charged before and now they are. His life has been threatened because the locals accuse him of monopolizing the natural resource, and they say that's not fair and that's not right. What do you think the heroes would do?
Well, two separate things have come to mind for me for this one that was actually not related to this at all. One was in the Wheel of Time series when they mentioned that the desert tribes, when they come across, which ended up playing a huge part, they said that they, like I said, they came from a desert region,
mm-hmm.
and they said their tribes have gone to war over puddles of water that people can step over, because water was so scarce in their region.
Wow, that's awesome. That's very much what's just kind of going on right here.
And also, in college, I had to watch the anti-musical, if you will. It was called Urine Town.
You're in town?
Yep.
Play on words?
Yep. Yeah. And the kind of like the entire overworking plot was the local water baron kind of like did manipulate all the rights for the local water supply, charging large amounts for water
mm-hmm.
and for toilet use. And of course, people rebel, they oust him and so on and so forth, but then they spit at the end. Yeah, it turns out, yeah, he's a dick in charge of our fight, but it turned out that his practice has actually kept the water used to control, so now that people are using it freely, they're now dying of thirst.
Out, yeah. So...
Like I said, it was an anti-musical, so they're happy ending and badly.
This puts the heroes in an interesting spot, though, right?
Yeah.
Because they're hired to protect this guy while killing him is wrong, and technically he might not be doing anything illegal. It's his property and his land. They're now tasked with, well, how bad can the DM make this player, this are you going to play this guy out as he truly feels he's the innocent victim and that this is his land and he's inherited it, it's his right, he isn't obligated to share it if he doesn't want to.
And maybe as I said in the example, maybe the fact he's charging it is keeping a limited supply in check.
Right. And or does the mob and the villagers convince the players that he's the bad guy and that while they can't pay him, what he's doing is wrong and they should help him, and then... You know, maybe they do. Maybe they do take sides with the villagers, and then they come back sometime later and find out there's a drought because they drank it all.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a nice touch that I hadn't thought of. I like that. But, you know, so do they, is there more to that? Do they end up uncovering a plot where the man is really planning to extort everyone and just trying to satisfy his greed, or is he really doing them a service?
Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, I think this is a really fun one, and I think you can really, once again, that moral ambiguity in how the DM portrays that the water rights owner and the villagers can really create an interesting roleplay scenario. So that'll do it for our encounter of the podcast, which is the water rights.
And next up on deck, we have our magic item, Tiamat's Chromatic Amulet. And
that sounds sexy.
Indeed, and this obscene amulet is laced with a frame that appears as a ever-changing mix of the chromatic colors. In the center, the five-headed dragon queen's image appears with a stoic visage, and this item can be used as an arcane focus. But wait, there's more.
This item has 1d4 charges.
Now, does it recharge, or is it a permanent amount of charges?
In my games, they almost always recharge at dawn. I forget to say that sometimes, I think. I've never really thought about it until you just brought it up, but I don't think I ever actually say that. But
because there are... Because I did...
They do run out.
Some items do, yeah, which kind of sucks, but it is what it is.
Yeah. No, this item has 1d4 charges and does... does recharge at dawn. When using this item as an arcane focus... You can use a charge to change the elemental damage type of the Firebolt cantrip to either cold, acid, lightning, fire, or poison.
Now, does it just have to be the Firebolt cantrip?
That's just the Firebolt cantrip.
Okay, just checking.
I didn't want to get... I considered maybe other abilities, but because I wanted it to be like Chromatic Orb.
Right.
But I wanted it to be slightly different and have a more utility usage, and overcoming resistances is a nice utility.
Chromatic Orb.
But to me... The best way to do that was to, well, what type of creature could do something like that? And a five-headed dragon definitely can do that.
Yep.
So I decided that she would be the inspiration for this item, but mostly it's just to create a mechanical advantage over elements.
Yeah.
Now, to a player, they might think this is the best thing in the world, but if you actually look, it's not really going to come into play that often, so it's not game-breaking at all.
No.
But it definitely can be really fun, too. Like, I envision if I was to use this thing that I would hold up the amulet and one of the heads would come out. Like, the black dragon head would come to life off the amulet and then spit the fire bolt out as the acid bolt,
yep.
Which I just think is really cool. So, what about you? You got anything else to add to that, how you think that would work or anything?
I just think it'd glow and they'll just change the element of the fire bolt as you fired it.
That's boring. I'm sorry, dude.
Boring's not necessarily bad.
You know what? You're not wrong. That is our magic item of the podcast, Tiamat's Chromatic Amulet.
And last but not least, well, actually, second to last, I should say, the Dungeon Master's Tip.
I'm pretty sure that I heard this. I got this over from the guys over at Interparty Conflict.
Quite possibly.
They had a guest on their show recently that talked about this, and it was directly, how does a DM represent playing an extremely intelligent creature? Because if you think about it...
By having them not fall for the obvious traps that most players expect monsters to fall for?
But it's more complex than that. Because if you've got a super villain, he's thinking 10 moves ahead, right? So how do you mechanically reflect that? He said that one of the things they had tried, or one they had success, was have your characters declare their actions in the initiative order before their turn, and they have to stick to that order. So that represents the genius creature being able to predict what they're going to do and react before they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just genius.
That could be interesting.
Now, that's something I probably wouldn't use a whole lot.
No.
But for, like, a big bad boss of the super genius... I think that this was an amazing idea and could really make a difficult challenge for the players. Because, A, they'd have to stick to their attack representative of what they were going to do unless something changed that would force that to change.
Or you can make it, too, where they don't do what they said they're going to do. They do their new action at disadvantage.
Oh, there you go. Where he may, so they would get punished if they change their way.
Yep.
That's an interesting way to look at that. I think it's really cool. It's a really... interesting mechanic to emulate the intelligent creature being able to really predict their attacks, and I about lost my mind when I heard him talking about it. I was just like, that's the coolest thing.
And now I'm thinking about the second story for JoJo's Bizarre Adventures.
Which one's that one?
The not the first one.
Because I think I started at the third one. Which one's the one with the stands?
The third one.
That's where I started.
Basically, it's the one where, like, you know his grandpa during the third arc, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's basically him when he was a teenager.
Oh, okay.
And he was a completely different character when he was a teenager.
Really? Well, yeah, I mean, people change, I guess.
Well, I mean, he was basically an arrogant, brash douchebag, but he also was a very intelligent one, too.
Did that, like, predict everyone?
To the point where he was actually...
finishing his opponent's sentences?
Yep, just to trip
them
up.
See what I did there? But what do you think about this?
Like you said, it would have to be done when that opponent is involved, but...
It'd be interesting. How would you feel as a player if you had to call out what you were going to do ahead of time?
Like you said, if it was just for this one creature, then it'd be like, holy crap.
Mm. Yeah, so you wouldn't have a problem with that if it was just, this guy's super smart and this is what I want to do to replicate
right.
him being able to predict your actions by having you tell me.
And you having to change your actions trips you up a little bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So that does it for our Dungeon Master tip. Our player tip of the podcast is,
don't be a dick.
And you can avoid dickitude by,
don't be afraid to get down.
Get down, good Lord. Baby's got it going all over town. Sorry. Going prone is often such a thing that's so bad that it's a synonym for it's bad. You can't do it, whatever. You don't want to be prone. But if you think about it, the person that uses a crossbow or makes ranged attacks can go prone and still not necessarily suffer the disadvantages and gain all the advantages of hiding from an opponent.
I do believe you do gain the defense with a short bow or a long bow.
You do, but
right.
if you're an unseen attacker, you get advantage and it offsets the disadvantage.
True, and if you're also a spellcaster with these ranged cantrips, you're also golden too.
Yeah, so you really could become a glorified sniper, and I can see the ranged sniper staying back as the team is assaulting like a heavily armored caravan or a set of soldiers, because really, once you shoot, they can crawl prone and get to another spot and then shoot with as an unseen attacker again.
So a warlock with the spell sniper feet with with a distance evocation.
Gonna wreck shit.
I can fire from 1,000 feet away.
And you can make it happen. I mean, as a DM, being able to set up an opportunity to somebody that's got a build like that, mm-hmm. this would be really great for them.
Whereas, or somebody with a sharpshooter feat, with a longbow, never mind, because, well, I mean, okay, yeah, that does make their 600-foot long range not suck, but
right.
that defeats the whole prone thing you're trying to go for right here.
Right, yeah. So the idea is that you'd be prone, and your disadvantage is offset by advantage.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to get into the dirt and use that, because that's one way to stay safe, especially if you got a smaller crew. This would be a good way to kind of deal with that. I've had to run a game for two people, one cleric and one ranger, and this was a kind of a scenario that they came up with that I really had to work around and encourage it, because I didn't want to punish him because the other guy didn't want to go into combat. He's like, you know what, you go and I'll cover you. and that way he can consume all of his heal slots trying to keep himself alive.
Right.
So we did deal with, he did finally get caught and spotted by a guard in a tie tower. But up until that point, he was able to wipe out almost all the guards on the outside without any penalties.
Right.
Which allowed them to better succeed going in because they didn't consume a bunch of heals, spells, and resources just trying to take out all the guards, and there was a lot of them. So don't be afraid to get down and get into prone and use that to your advantage to take out enemies from a distance like a sniper. Do you have anything you'd like to touch on with that? Any other advantages and things you can see going on there?
I think we can have touched on the topic fairly well.
All right, and don't be afraid just on the ground. You can also, like, climb on top of buildings and go prone.
Yep.
And from distance and still make it difficult to really see you. That does it for our player tip. Don't be a dick, and you can avoid dickitude by...
Don't be afraid to get down. And now we give away our last prize to the night from our sponsor, Jeff Stevenson.
It's been a long few days of travel, and the adventurers are tired of eating rations and sleeping on the ground. The road opens to a small town with an inviting tavern. The smells of grilling meat and ale fill their nostrils, and the sound of laughter and music float out the tavern's door. Unlucky for the adventurers, they've stumbled upon Dragon's Breath Tavern. What starts out as a pleasant evening of food, drink, and entertainment soon evolves into an adventure that takes the party into and under Dragon's Breath Tavern. The adventure includes roleplay, exploration, combat, and a dice game called Demon Dice.
Who's our winner?
Our winner for this week is Sam Kiwis.
You ever seen Night at the Rockberries?
When no.
They'll do this. They're doing that in the whole car ride. Congratulations. If you like the adventure, please let Jeff know. You can leave him a review. Let him know what you like, what you didn't like. Interesting fact, Jeff will be joining us on a future episode. He just released another one of his Savage encounters.
Nice.
This is Savage Jungle Encounters, I think. And he sent us a copy for us to check out. I have not had an opportunity yet, but I'm super excited to have him on.
In closing, please join us on our next episode where we hear feedback from our heroes. And also, we shall be discussing Thanissar's Guide to Everything's The Archetype for the Monks. If you have any feedback, unearthed tips and tricks, or topics you'd like to discuss, please send them to us. And you can email them to us at critacademy@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Crit Academy.
We hope you enjoyed your experience here at Crit Academy. If you did, you can help others find our show by leaving a hopefully 5-star review on iTunes or on your platform of choice. Or you can just send us a message telling us how fantastic we are. Also, be sure to give us a like and a share on our show posts, or any of our posts for that matter. We don't pay for advertising, so you guys are our source of advertising. Every like, every share brings more to Crit Nation, so... that's a really easy and cheap way to support the show.
And also, make sure to subscribe to our show at CritAcademy.com so we can help you on your future adventures, as well as give you a chance to win cool prizes each and every week. You'll find links to our fellowship members there as well.
Yeah, make sure to check out our fellowship members. They're all really awesome. You got Jeff Stevens, Lore Smith, and Goblinstone are all of our sponsors. They've got great adventures. You can go and check out their stuff and support them. Interparty Conflict, those guys are awesome. Their entire show is answering your questions, and they're very good at it. And then, of course, you've got the awesome guys over at D&D Character Lab, where they write out character concepts and then argue their validity over the mic, and you get to hear about it. And their character concepts are so fleshed out. If you don't have any good ideas, just listen to one or two episodes, and you'll have a fully fleshed out character you can take with you, which Indeed. Is pretty cool. And then, of course, Orican's Lair does an awesome job of... writing reviews and sharing content in regards to all the everything D&D. I am your host, Justin.
And I'm your co-host, Ian. Thanks for listening.
Keep your blades sharp and spells prepared, heroes.
And all you fighters, be sure to keep in mind to have a wide variety of weapons.
Ooh, like that. Yeah, when you don't have a weapon, use your fists, which isn't classified as a weapon.
No. No, it is not.